everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And I'm here with my co-host, I'm never solo, with Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Jess. I am Craig Campbell. I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I also make tabletop role-playing games. And we are in the midst of our, what I like to think of as our three-part series of, hey, that's a brand new guest. So part two... Navi, hello and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, you guys. I'm Navi, and I'm one half of a couple of Drake's Publishing. We've done a whole boatload of games. Court of Blades and Dead Belt are kind of chief among them. Right now, Faborg is in production to fulfill a Kickstarter. And we got some other cool stuff coming out soon, but we got tons of Ashcans. Like, that's kind of our jam. Yeah, that's me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Very excited to have you on. And we're talking today about solo games. One of my favorite topics. I love solo games. Would either you or Craig, would either of you two like to introduce this topic to our listeners?
Oh, well, solo games are games you play by yourself.
period. Done.
Period. So I expect that we'll talk quite a lot about, you know, solo games out there and design of solo games, because there's not so much GMing going on with a solo game. The other point of view that we often take, although when you play a solo game with certain solo games, you can kind of switch between modes of like, okay, now I'm doing a GM thing where I'm going to describe it, lay the scene, kind of set things up and everything. And I'm going to establish the world and NPCs and whatnot. And now I'm going to switch to player mode and I'm going to like interact with that thing I just invented. And do it from the character's point of view rather than from the imagination of the GM side of my brain. So we can, you know, maybe kind of talk about that a little bit too. There's sort of a little bit of that with certain games. But yeah, this was Navi picked this from our list of potential topics. So what got you thinking like, oh, that's a thing I want to talk about?
So I have a love of solo games, and I think that solo games are a little challenging because you really need to make sure that there's enough for people to go on to feel satisfied playing it by themselves. I find that sometimes with solo games, there's just not enough meat for people to play on, so that they won't play for very long, or they'll play, you know, they'll really drive it like they stole it because they know that they're not going to want to play a long game of something because it's just a lot of work to do a solo game. So the challenge of working with solo rules is one of my favorite. We currently have two solo games. One is a pretty standard journaling game, which is fun. You kind of play as a airship where you are going through different eras, and you change you change the hands of crews and captains as you go through these different eras, and it's based on the Lost and Found system. So it's really a heartfelt game. So it really pulls at the heartstrings. The prompts are meant to give you an emotional response, and I think that was a fun way of engaging with people and really getting them to play that solo game. And then on the other hand, we did Dead Belt, which was much more prescriptive, where you do, when you do something, there is an answer. And so you have prompts, and you have a certain amount of stats that you can use to navigate these prompts. And at a certain point, because of decrementing dice, you eventually get to the point where you have to run back and like you have to stop. And I think that was two different ways of tackling solo, but both are very satisfying, and you don't want to put them down until you finish it. You don't feel like you have to rush through it, or you don't get bored with it. So my love of solo is making solo that I want to play. It's kind of a terrible thing to say, but it's true. It's a challenge. It's a difficult system to execute well.
I don't think that's a terrible thing to say at all. I think if we all design games that we wanted to play, then everyone's going to have a fun time. That's also my philosophy when I'm writing a solo game. I wanted to make a solo game that's like, you know, the little game you play in your head. Like when you were a kid, like, oh, I'm a spy and I'm gonna like do all this spy stuff. Like, I made a solo game based off of that, and like all the little games I would play as a kid, like to be a spy. And those kinds of experiences are really rewarding because you get to kind of showcase your own imagination and invite other people to kind of play in that space with you. And that's what I really, really like about solo games. You just have like no There are no other expectations on you as a player. You don't have to impress anybody. No one has to see what you're doing. No one's checking in on you. You just can let it run wild. And if you do want to put it down, you're not having fun with the game. You're not disappointing anyone by saying, eh, I'm done, and like putting it back on the shelf. Unlike so if you dropped out of a multiple player campaign, for example.
That's actually a really big thing in our home group. We'll, because we play with the same group all the time, and we like to try a lot of different games, and it's always a countdown to figure out who at the table is going to be the first to go, man, this is not my game.
Right. You only have the one person to satisfy. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, I mean, that's kind of also a challenge as the game designer, because like you said, you do have to make it a satisfying experience for the player. And like, you have to give them all the tools so they can make it a satisfying experience for themselves. But at the same time, like as the player, there's not, just pick it up and go.
Yeah.
I think one of the, just speaking to that really quickly, I think one of the neat things about designing a solo game is that you can do, like, here's a game that does this very specific thing. And there's an audience of people out there that want to play a game that does this very specific thing. So many other RPGs can be like, well, you can play it this way, you can play it that way, you can have a mix of characters that have different goals, and like they'll have different shining moments and that sort of thing. Whereas like, this is like, you can get really specific and be like, I want literally to have a game that, you know, you are an airship, and we're going to talk about history, and we're going to make everybody tear up, make the players tear up a little bit and get a little melancholy. You know, that is its self-contained experience. I think that's one of the beautiful things about a solo game, is that it can give you a very specific and directed experience of a particular type, that doesn't have to have options for having all this other stuff.
No, I completely agree. And I mean, indie is really good at niche experience anyways. Even amongst multiplayer games, indie games tend to be all like, we're going to deliver something very strange. But with solo, you don't have to worry about getting an entire group on board, because that's another thing that happens in our group. Like, there's a game I've been dying to play. My group won't touch it because there's a couple of players that have no interest in it, even though I'm dying to play it. And so with a solo game, it's like, well, I can have that niche experience by myself, and I don't have to talk four other people into wanting to have that experience with me. So I completely agree. It's really fantastic in that regard. You can have some really beautiful moments too. I know there's other journaling games that really are, in that same vein, they really make you think. Thousand-Year-Old Vampire was one of those for me. Like, it got me into journaling games in the first place, reading that one, because it's so deep and interesting and kind of like sad, because you're going through and like trading your memories in over time because your life is so long. So that was a really cool experience. But I agree, the whole niche thing, it's so great, because again, like, I don't have to convince everyone else that, like, hey, let's all, like, Tiny Wanderer is one I picked up recently that I'm in love with. You just print out this little tiny man and you take him to places based on the prompts that you roll up and take photos of him in these places. And that's so up my alley. And I don't think I could sell anyone else on coming out and playing that with me. Let's go photograph the little paper man.
So, I need to check that one out. You've mentioned a couple times now, Navi, you've mentioned journaling games, and mm-hmm. you said like, oh, this is a traditional journaling game. Uh-huh. What do you mean by that? What does that mean?
Okay, so to me, a traditional journaling game is, regardless of how you get to the prompts, it is a series of, you get to the prompt and you answer the prompt. That is a journaling game, to me, a classic journaling game. I give you a very specific prompt, and however you're inspired to answer that prompt is correct. The mechanics that get you to picking that prompt or get you to a certain prompt aren't as important as the fact that that is what a journaling game is at its heart. In my opinion, a traditional journaling game, I give you a prompt, you answer the prompt, then you have the mechanics, whatever they are, to get you to the next prompt, and you answer that prompt. And hopefully by the end, you have a very satisfying story that kind of is cohesive.
I've played a game where you're not necessarily answering prompts. It's a game, I've talked about it on this podcast. I literally just talked about it a little bit ago, called Apothecaria. Mm-hmm. And you're not given a prompt necessarily, but you're building a patient and a disease, and then going out and finding reagents to go build a potion to cure them. And the prompts like kind of exist, yes, because things happen while you're going out and exploring and you're supposed to react to those. But they don't necessarily ask you questions in the same way that a lot of the, like you said, a traditional journaling game does. And I really liked that. I really liked that style of mechanic where I'm doing something else too. Like I'm collecting, I'm doing blah, blah, blah. I'm taking my tiny man and taking a picture, whatever it is.
Right.
There's another game called the Sticker Game that is like part solo game.
I love Cassie.
Yes. Such it's a good designer. So cool. And you have like this radio drama happening and you're using your sticker collection yes, they're answering prompts, and it's not very traditional because it also involves this audio text instead of just a here are your cards, here's your book with your prompts. I think that there's a lot of really cool, fun, innovative things happening in the world of solo games, and you can find an experience basically for everything right now. Or as a game designer, it's so much easier to create something completely new and exciting. It's much less saturated than say, oh, I'm making a tabletop role playing game that's high fantasy for 5 to 7 players and a GM.
With
all these options and all these things and add-ons and supplements and how do I handle all that stuff? Like, yeah.
I also find that with solo games, it's easier to get folks to commit to playing it on streams or doing video or, you know, whatever, which helps a lot with getting it out there and getting it, because marketing as an indie designer is like one of the toughest things, right? So solo games, once again, because only one person has to be like, this is really cool. I definitely found that our solo games get a lot more airtime and shared around and passed around and talked about even more than our big multiplayer games, because it's just that mindset of I don't need a group to do this, I can just enjoy this, and if you happen to also enjoy this, you can come watch it. So it also makes great content for people who are into that solo gaming thing. It's definitely a thing.
What does that look like on a stream? I've never seen someone play a solo game on a stream.
So it depends on the solo game, because again, journaling games can be a little bit more complicated. So if you were to play, I've seen some of them played on stream, but when you typically play a journaling game on stream, it's not as deep. You don't do as much responding to the prompts. So it'll usually be like, you'll come up with a cute little skit and then move on to the next part just so you can play through. But with games that are more like Starforged, man, people really get into it. They bust out like miniatures and maps, and you get the overhead view as they're making up the story. And that's really, really cool to see. I've seen a lot of folks play Deadbolt on stream, and we actually made like a little slap together VTT thing so that you can play it easily on screen without having to do it. But I've also seen people just, again, bust out that overhead camera so that they can show the ship layout as they lay it out themselves and play more physically. So you can play that particular game either way, but folks really, they just go for it. They find a way.
from what I've seen and heard too, that there can be a tendency among actual play streams or videos of solo games that you get to see like the mechanics feature the mechanics or like how the game is written and brought forth for the player plays a bigger role, because it's one person that just is going to be like, okay, and then the game says I do this and then I do this, and so they're explaining a little bit more of it, whereas like with GM and player RPGs, they can go long periods of just the characters are role playing their characters and you don't necessarily see the mechanics functioning on and there's even APs where the mechanics are very background and it's much more like a little video play, like they're putting on a it's a performance and a play and a TV show, and the mechanics are very much in the background. But like I had some people who streamed Secrets of the Vibrant Isle when that was kickstarting, and they did that sort of thing where they would flip through the pages, like they had the PDF captured on the screen, and they could flip through the pages and show you where, like, okay, we're going to this spot in the book, and this is the thing I rolled, and this is what I got to do. And then they could show you the character sheet, and they could talk about what was happening. Because Secrets of the Vibrant Isle plays a little bit more like a traditional, a little bit more like an RPG with like a character sheet and things that, you know, adventure that you go on and encounters that you run into. But it involves you kind of bouncing through the book. It plays like an RPG with a character version kind of like choose your own adventure stories, where you make choices about the different types of things you want to do on the island. And then there's random rolls to determine exactly what that is and goes from there. So people actually got to see like the mechanics in action, or like, or how, you know, like the functional aspects of how the game plays, as opposed to just listening to narrative discussion and role-playing.
Mm-hmm. It's so difficult because I love a journaling game. I love like creating a story, while I'm playing the role-playing game in a way that I can do, like I can't really do as easily if I'm at the table with a bunch of other people. Because I can't just boss them around and tell them what I want them to do. I get control over all of my people, and I get to make the story, and I get to be in charge. But because I like that aspect, I think that that's a harder element to bring to a stream. Like, ooh, I'm sitting here and I'm writing this whole thing. You would have to be, I feel like, such a great improv actor in order to like say that stuff off the cuff on the stream for everyone to enjoy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I can definitely see how, like, especially if you have the art incorporated, or if you have a like minis, a little paper guy, you have mechanics. If you're a solo game developer in the indie space thinking about like, okay, what are the cool things I can show off physically that are going to make people be like, oh, this looks interesting, let me try that out. I think even like the presentation of the book, like Thousand Year Old Vampire looking like an ancient journal of a thousand year old vampire. Like those are little things you can do as a designer that can maybe help you market your game a little bit better. I have personally found, though, that solo games are incredibly marketable at conventions. People love to pick up a smaller game that they can play by themselves, because the number one complaint I hear from players is, I don't have time to play this with a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. I have a family now, or I don't have people to play with.
Hard to get scheduling done. Yeah.
Yes. They're so popular, and they're growing in popularity, and they're very easy to sell. Just like they're easy to sell at a convention, and all of the conventions I've been at where we're selling solo games, they're like flying off the shelves.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I mean, I love solo games. I want to see more come out. I get so excited when I see like a new one that like I'm not one of those people who wants to see new mechanics. New mechanics don't impress me. I don't know. I don't care. If there's new mechanics and it's a new system, fantastic. If there's not, fantastic. Just give me something really cool, like thematic.
Yeah.
And like with tone that inspires me. That's all I care about. All the other stuff falls to the wayside for me. It's not important.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's especially true for a solo game where you are primarily working within your own imagination. You don't need a lot of bells and whistles. You just need the hook. You need the okay, someone come out with the Wooing Mr. Darcy game for me as a solo game, and I'll instantly play that, because guess what? I haven't been able to find is someone to play Good Society with, for example.
Another thing that I like about them, and that they, something you can keep in mind when you're designing one, or when you're looking for the type of game you want to play too, is that they can often, almost all the time, they can be played in little tiny increments. You know, with a bigger, you know, group game, you're probably looking to play for a longer period of time. You're looking to, like, ideally, if it's a campaign, like, well, we want to have every episode end on a satisfying note. We want to have like a cliffhanger or some sort of closure to a moment. Whereas you can take a solo game and be like, you know, I have so little time this week, but I'm gonna wedge this thing in here because I want to have a little bit of fun with this, and I'm gonna play, you know, for 15 minutes here and 15 minutes there and 15 minutes there, and I'm gonna slowly string this all together and make my little story or go on my little adventure or whatever it is. And you don't have to satisfy anybody's need to hit certain marks. You know, you can just be like, okay, this is a good point to stop. I got to get back to work, or I got to get back to the family, or I got errands to run. And then you can pick it up again and be like, oh yeah, that's where I was. All right, here we go. And you don't have to bring anybody up to speed. you can just be ready to go, because like there's so much less, it's a much lower impact kind of thing that you can mold it to your life very easily.
I agree. And typically solo games don't have a lot of frufru. So like you can really pop it in your pocket or just have the PDF on your phone and play it from anywhere. So lunch break, I got 10 minutes. I'm going to like answer this prompt, or I'm going to like run through this ship real quick, or whatever it is that you're doing. It's really, it is really wonderful in that regard, that you can squeeze it in and have like a little bit of fun, creative time. And it doesn't interfere with anything else, and it doesn't require a group and buy-in and scheduling.
So let's talk a little bit about coming up with that idea for a solo game. Since that, like you said, Navi, that's the thing you want. You want a good concept. How do we as game designers think of a good concept that would be good for a solo game?
Oh, okay. So I honestly believe that I'm not good at coming up with game concepts that sell. I'm good at coming up with game concepts that I want to play. I very much suffer from the 20-80. 20% of my games make 80% of my income, because nobody cares about the other 80% of the games, but I still made them. So it depends. Are you making games to satisfy yourself, to satisfy a specific niche, or are you doing it because you want it to be a financial success, a capitalist success? To that effect, sometimes when we're working on game ideas, I'm like, okay, this game is never going to sell. And we'll make it and we'll love it. But I know while we're writing it, as soon as we hear that pitch, I'm like, nobody's buying this game. Versus sometimes there's game pitches where we're like, this game is going to sell like gangbusters. And I've gotten pretty good at identifying it. My sin is that I don't care. So I'll still make the games that nobody wants. So what I suggest doing is, anytime you have an idea about a game, just write it down, keep it as fodder, throw it into a folder, even if you don't look at it anytime soon. No ideas are wasted. If there was something that caught your attention, made you think it was a good idea, there might be a nugget of that later that you can like plumb and pull out. So save all of your ideas, no matter how bad they are. And something else that I find super helpful for generating game ideas is we do like pitch games. For instance, there was an Art October thing that came out, and it was like 30 prompts a day, and you were supposed to doodle something that like was reflective of that word of the day. And instead we're like, all right, let's pitch a game every single day for 30 days based on those prompts. And some of them were so bad, but you just had to get prompt done that day, or you had to get a pitch done that day. So we just put it out there no matter how bad it was. And some of them ended up being really fantastic. A couple of them we've actually started working on. One of them recently just got released as an ash can. So nothing is wasted, even though that particular Pitchtober was not this last October, but the previous October, we dug a game out of there and did a game sprint just to kind of freshen up our minds. A game sprint is almost like a game jam, except for there's no jam going on. Sean and I will just go, you know what, we haven't put out anything new recently, let's just put our heads down and make a really cool ash can real quick, and we'll usually create an entire game in a month. Like that's the deadline. We have to finish the game and release the ash can within a month in order for it to like meet that criteria. And it kind of keeps us really keeps creative juices moving, basically, like stops you from getting stagnant, and it gives you that moment to go and work on something that maybe isn't going to sell and maybe no one cares about, but like it also still improves your ability as a designer, and it's going to have nuggets of stuff and maybe new mechanics will move into a more successful piece later. So yeah, when it comes to making up game ideas, I don't have an easy answer. My answer is everything. Everything's an idea, and write it all down. Use what you can.
Everything you said there. So I also designed with my husband, and we did very, very similar things to you. once a week, we would sit down and for an hour, we would design a game on stream. We would stream this and we would design a game and we just like, we would pitch each other these random ideas that made sense maybe 10% of the time. And we would just make the game. And it was a really, really good exercise. I agree with you. Like they were our own game sprints. We didn't call them that. We were just designing. Just the idea of trying and trying things out, writing them down, putting them in the folders. Eventually, you're going to come up to a nugget. You and I sound very, very similar too in our philosophy. The 20-80% is real. And I will also make the silly game that no one cares about because I care about it. And someone else might too. Not everything you publish has to be marketable. Yes. Sometimes you do. It does. Like I said at the very beginning, like, and what you had mentioned, making the game that you want to play is a valuable exercise in and of itself. That's also a form of play for you as you're making something. And I mean, hopefully we're, you know, all having fun with what we're doing.
I hope so. It'd be awful if you were a game designer and you weren't having fun. Yeah. I make fun for a living and I'm not having fun.
Right. A very sad world. Willy Wonka not enjoying his own chocolate.
I found myself thinking that there's, you know, when Navi was talking about the idea of putting all your ideas somewhere and putting them all, you know, having a big bucket full of ideas that are, you know, varying degrees of expanded or complete or, you know, built up, where, and I've got that folder of like a whole bunch of little documents of like, sometimes it's just like literally here's a Word document that has the name of a game and a sentence of what the game is about. And that's all I got with it so far. And then there's other ones where I maybe did some bullet points for some ideas. And I find myself thinking like at some point, it hasn't happened yet, but I have the feeling that it's going to happen because I have thought about it with a few different game ideas, is that if you've got this idea for a game and it's a group game and it's something's like, oh, it's, I really like to make this, but you know, again, it maybe it's really weird and super niche. And you're just having trouble kind of like, well, how can I turn this into something that, you know, like a group of people can play and they might, you know, a group of people want to play, that maybe you take a step back and say, okay, well, what would this idea look like as a solo game? Like, can I pair it back to an essence, especially if it's a very specific type of experience, and turn it into a journaling game or a simple dice mechanic sort of adventure game or a game that, you know, is, you know, just like intended to just kind of get you to a certain place emotionally or to create a nice memory or whatever it is you're trying to do with the game. Like maybe that's, you know, maybe it's very possible that some of the ideas I have sitting in that folder are literally just like, oh, that's a great solo game. I just haven't taken the time to think about what it might be as a solo game.
Oh, that's a beautiful idea. That's a great point, because I think a lot of us do kind of think, well, we need to make the big multiplayer game because that's what the capitalism wants. But so I promise you, solo games can do well. They can also do well, but often they're not thought of as like a serious real game, because we just don't see very many of them. You walk into the game store and what do you see? Mostly those big old tomes. They want the biggest, fattest, highest dollar book on the shelf. And I think that gives a false kind of impression of what the game market can bear, or what even if we're not talking about capitalism, what do people want to play? I kind of always go back to the capitalism thing because I'm a full-time game designer. So naturally I'm always kind of thinking of games in terms of financial return, but that's not always true. And especially if you're a hobbyist and you just want to create games as a hobby, it's not part of your income. Do what you like first, and the more stuff that you make, the better you'll get at designing is the other thing. You'll get better at game designing the more games that you design. When I first started, I started with what are those things called? SRDs. I'd grab other people's SRDs and I'd build fun games on their SRDs, and they'd be really just really blown up hacks, basically. And then I've gotten to the point now where, like, the last game that we made when we did a game sprint, I just opened up a doc and wrote the entire thing from scratch because I already had an idea in my head of what I wanted to do and how it was going to work. And I've laid out so many games, I knew exactly how to lay everything out in the right, you know, area. So the more games that you design, the better you'll get at game design. So don't try to create and make everything your magnum opus. Make what's fun and make solo games. They're so good. Like, they're so easy to play test. You can play test it by yourself. You don't need a group to play test it. That's actually my favorite favorite part of making solo games is that I don't have to find a group and schedule people to play test the damn game, when especially when it's raw. Like, play testing a raw game is not very fun. Yep. And then you're like, hey guys, how'd you feel about that pile of crap I just made you play? It's not pretty.
There's something to be said for solo games and playtesting too, now that you bring that up. Is like, it's not necessarily always the case, and it always depends on your own particular feelings on when something is ready, quote unquote, right? Mm-hmm. But solo games can be incredibly easy to play test, and like it's not that intensive, because a lot of time many of them don't play that long, don't take as long to play, so you can get people to try it out. Just like, it's a little short thing that I'm just going to write this little story, or it's just it's got less moving parts, you know. Mm-hmm. there may not be mechanics to really worry about too much, or very simple mechanics. So there's that, which can be a real boon to, like, you know, like, one of the things I remark all the time is I love designing games, but even more, I love having designed a game. And that means having to get through all of the steps to getting the game done. And one of those steps is playtesting. And sometimes when something is taking a while to come together, playtesting can be a little grueling, because you want so badly for it to be like, I want this so to work. Like, why doesn't it work? But with a lighter game, just a smaller scale game in general, in a solo game in particular, you can kind of, you know, you may be able to get through that faster, and gets you to that satisfaction of like, oh, this is the thing that is done. It works. It does what I want it to do. And that's very satisfying too, is like not spending a ton of time on something and getting a little faster turnaround on your satisfaction level.
Yeah. And not, I mean, and there's so many SRDs even for solo games out. If folks are interested in game design and they don't know what SRDs are, it's something you should get friendly with. Rune, I know, has an SRD, which is a kind of solo action dungeon delving kind of game. Carta is wonderful. Carta was the first building blocks that we used to make Dead Belt. Dead Belt obviously became its own monster after a while, but Carta was wonderful. And then we released the SRD for even Dead Belt. I can't remember the name of the author. I'm so sorry. I'm a horrible person. But and this is a friend too, but I have COVID brain, so you have to forgive me. My brain is fried. please don't be mad at me. I love you. So London Summer was based on the Dead Belt hack, or the Born on the Belt hack. And it's fantastic. You play a female pickpocket, kind of like in the Victorian era, and you're at this big gala, and you're kind of like going around and you're trying to steal the valuables and things off these people without getting caught. And like, it's so fun. And it was based off of an SRD that we threw out there. Again, we did Skyworthy off of the Lost and Found SRD, which is from Bucket of Bolts, which is another fantastic journaling game. That one's kind of in the spirit of the spaceships that you would fly, being the spaceship that you would fly in like the Star Wars type setting, right? So that was super, super cute and inspiring. But because these SRDs already exist, I know I'm forgetting a bunch. I think Starforged has its own SRD, which is a very, very deep solo game.
The Wretched and Alone series has one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, and so right there, it's already a pile of mechanics that the authors are openly saying, hey, use these mechanics and slap your own stories and themes on it. So familiarizing yourself with games, and then familiarizing yourself with SRDs, you don't even have to do a ton of mechanical work to get those first few games out. And again, after you get a little bit underneath your belt, it's going to become much more easier. You're going to feel more confident and comfortable messing with rules and like breaking them and adding new stuff and like, I'm going to try this other crazy thing. But you don't have to come into it swinging. Like, solo games, you don't have to come in swinging. You can totally grab a solo SRD and make an amazing game and not have to be overly concerned about how much you know about the mechanical side of game design.
And you can, like, I would also recommend playing a lot of the games too, and then you can start generating those ideas like, ooh, this would be fun to play this game like this, but instead of being pirates, we are on a road trip, like whatever it ends up being. And then you can just do that. Like, you can easily... And there's no shame in not designing your own mechanics for something either. You are still doing just as much game design. You're going to have to tweak things anyway. Like, all of those pieces still apply. And the SRDs are out there. Like you said, the SRDs are out there for a reason, because people like when you use their games. They like when you use those. That's why they put them out. It's also good for them.
I was gonna say, from a player perspective, even I, like, it's just a system I love, and I see a new game come out on the system I already love. Like, right. it's an easy purchase for me. I'm like, yes, that is, I'm going to have to play that because I already love that. It's not necessarily a solo system, but Forge in the Dark is one of those for me. If a Forge in the Dark game comes out, it's an instant purchase from me. I got to see what they did, what mechanics they decided to keep, which ones they decided not to keep, and like I'm excited about it. So if you you can almost like tag on other onto other folks's like coattails, like I'm gonna borrow your greatness, because people do fall in love with systems. If I really really like the way something plays, I'm gonna like your game if it plays the same way.
Absolutely. Another idea generation that we actually were talking about this before you hopped on the call. Mm-hmm. We, Craig and I, looked up a list of movies with only one character. And there's a lot of them out there.
We were in a solo mode, and we got talking about movies with just one character, or one character that dominates like the whole thing. And there's,
I was gonna say, are we talking about like one character only?
It varies.
Well, there's a couple.
So like I Am Legend, right?
Like, yeah, stuff right. Like that. You're the last human on an earth filled with vampires, and you're mm-hmm. trying to survive, and maybe you're slowly discovering the story of these vampires who turn out to be, you know, their own actual society, if we're following the book and not the movie. Whatever it is, maybe you are the monster in the end. Like that's perfectly right already. That's built in for you. Mm-hmm. Craig was talking about one about a person who is running out of oxygen in her hypersleep chamber. Like, there are lots of ideas you can get just from straight up copying somebody else's. But it's still going to be your own. We're all building off of our own stuff. The other secret about game design is that game mechanics cannot be copyrighted, and you can. Is it an ethical practice always? No. But you can just take a game mechanic that works and use it. No one has to give you that permission. You do need to say, like, if you're taking the exact words of somebody, obviously that's copyright. Or if you are taking somebody's game mechanic, it's good practice for you to say, hey, I was inspired by this, and not imply that they endorse it. Those are all good practices. But also in the same way of ideas, that you can take a general concept, general idea of a movie that you liked or a series that you liked, and revamp it in a way that's yours, without running into an issue of, oh, I actually just straight up stole and plagiarized this. Obviously, again, with the caveat that you have to still follow all the regular ethical everything and moral.
What's that
everything.
Saying? Steal like an artist. I think that yes. I think steal like an artist is coming into play. But that's actually exactly. A really great point about the mechanics, because mechanics cannot be copyrighted. It's an honor system. If you use someone's system, you can say that it's based on their system, but you actually don't have to. And then, of course, acknowledgements, have an acknowledgements page where you say where you got certain ideas from is very cool. But it's all honor system. You don't have to do it. It's just generally cooler if you do. But I don't think a lot of people realize you can't copyright mechanics, not the words, not how they phrase things, but the mechanics themselves are not copyrightable. You can pilfer all of those. And I have so many games that I purchased just because I wanted to see if there was any good mechanics to steal.
Me too. Me too.
The way I've heard it phrased is, you can't copyright rules. You can only copyright the expression of the rules.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. No one's stopping you from writing, I roll a 20-sided die, and then I add a number to it that's based off of my character's strength. No one can tell you that you can't do that. I am constantly taking ideas from other places. I think that's just natural creativity. Again, like you said, Navi, there's a lot of honor system stuff, and being honest where you get your ideas, I just think is a good practice anyway. like this is inspired by, because there's no harm in doing that. And it shows other new designers or people who might be thinking about designing something that this is where people get their ideas. People are not just sprouting ideas fully formed from their heads in a vacuum. That doesn't happen. Right. There's no cloistered monastery up in the forest that's coming out with the newest, latest, greatest TTRPG.
Can we work on that though?
Actually. let's talk with our remaining time. What are some things that we should do as designers of solo games that make it an entertaining solo experience?
Oh boy. I think that emotion and tone are the most important things in a solo game. If you need to be either inviting someone in to really set the scene, to make them feel like they're a part of the story, that they care about it. People, we're all very selfish, naturally. We need to care about something to be invested in it. If you can't drive that feeling of really bringing someone into the world, they're not going to hold on to it very long. So I think that tone and theme are the most important. If it's a journaling game, whatever the overarching theme is, man, I want you to make me feel like it's there. If this is an action journaling game, I want to feel like I'm a badass hero, and like I want the prompts to like invoke that, like those moments of like, something is happening and only I can save the day. What will I do to fix this? I want that. If it's meant to be melancholy, I want you to make me cry. If you can make me cry, I'm going to give you the 5-star review. Just Adam, that's my rule. It's the same thing for TV. Anybody who can make me cry, I'm like, oh, thank God, it's like catharsis or something. Please make me cry. But I like, really, I want that. I want that to be brought. Anytime that I find a solo game that falls flat for me, it's because it was very bland. It wasn't written from a perspective of trying to drive that tone, trying to drive a theme, trying to make me feel like it's very much like, here's a set of words that read like stereo instructions. Don't you feel like you're this hero now? And it's like, no, I don't, because the word choice is wrong. And so depending on what you're doing, I think that's also important to be well-read. You should read lots of material in the genre that you're trying to emulate through game design, because that's going to help you with nailing down that tone and theme. Because the words on the paper is really all that there is for a solo game. Not all of them though, because again, Tiny Wanderer, like I said, it's like you print out a little paper band and you roll on this cute little chart that gives you like some random prompts, and you have to go find something in the world that represents those prompts and take a picture of your little man. That doesn't need a lot of theme. Like that's amazing just by itself. So I'm not saying everything, but if you're creating a journaling game, if you're creating like a really deep game with a story that you want people to feel like they're a part of, that's when the tone and theme really matters. And those are the biggest things for me, is to, you want to be a better solo game designer, focus on tone and focus on theme.
Absolutely. That's so huge. And then also giving either the player or the character that the player is playing something that they want right away. They need to like have a mission to get themselves involved right away. Exploration just by itself, I love it as a solo game, but like, why am I exploring this? What do I want out of it? Am I looking for something? Even if you don't define that as the game designer, like you should ask the player, what are you looking for? Why are you here? And even they're coming up with a goal on themselves, and they're gonna speed off with that. I also really like, for that same reason, I love a solo game with a specific end game and a countdown clock. Like, I need to figure this out before that happens, before I run out of my cards and my deck, whatever it is. If there is a time crunch and a time limit, I already start to feel that tension, and I want to get there. Maybe that I'm flipping cards like like nothing else, or I'm just more willing to come back to the game and solve whatever I was doing and overcome those obstacles. And I think the same thing happens like with challenges. Like you should have some sort of challenge built in, even if it's like a little challenge, like it's an emotional hill you have to get over, Like I'm thinking about with Craig's game, like sometimes there are physical challenges in the world you have to overcome. You have to do these certain things in order to proceed. Giving the player a challenge I think is the biggest key from going from, this is just an imagination exercise to, oh, this is a game I'm playing.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just me sitting around with myself thinking about a story I could have done anyway.
I am like 100% with you. Win states are one of my favorite things. I am so hooked on win states. I put them into multiplayer games. So like if you sit down and play Court of Blades, you'll notice that what you're doing is you're trying to push the house that you serve to be ranked as the top house in the entire city. And that's the win condition. And there's tons of meat and tons of stuff built in to help you get to that point eventually. And you might not even play that long, depending on how long you're playing, but there is still a win state for the game, even though it's a huge campaign long game. Something about victory, something about winning a win state, a victory goal. It's exciting in games. And I think that all satisfying stories need an end. Otherwise they meander and they peter out, and it's not as satisfying to not have that exclamation point at the end, that finality, that like, I've defeated this. I've accomplished something.
My two solo games are very much built around that. I love the win condition. I just find myself like, it's weird that the discussion we had last time and now this time, like I'm finding all these things that came up. I was like, oh yeah, I do that. I just literally wrap design on something that is heavily focused on a win condition. Because mm-hmm. it's a GM-less game. So it needs to have, or for the purposes of the game, it needs to have a way to determine whether or not you do the thing that you were trying to do for that story. I find myself, when it comes to the solo game thing, one of the things I find myself thinking about too is, Navi talked about, you know, pulling SRD or borrowing mechanics or ideas for mechanics. When it comes to borrowing mechanics, reskinning, tweaking mechanics, or even coming up with new mechanics with a solo game, you can go weird. It's very easy to do something really out of the ordinary because you're not asking the players to commit to playing a year-long campaign using this bizarre mechanic or this like weird convoluted thing or using a weird randomizer or whatever it is. There's a freedom in being able to just, you know, create something that uses a strange game mechanic, whether, you know, if it's a solo game or if it's just a very small scale kind of group game. I've been following a thread by guest of the show, Starshine, who was designed a bunch of games that have weird mechanics. I designed a little one page game that it's a group game, but it's basically, it uses short-term memory as a game mechanic, whether or not you can remember some things, mm-hmm. not a game for everybody, but it was an interesting experiment, and you know, for people who are interested in a game that, you know, is built around that, because there's like kids games that are like that, you know, like where you gotta remember, you know, whatever it's called, the one where you gotta remember the tiles and you gotta match the tiles, you know. those are games that we've played, but with game mechanics, yeah, you can do something weird. You can mix and match dice with cards, with coin flips, with rock paper scissors, with, you know, that flower looking thing that kids made in middle school that you flip open and has different numbers and you got to make choices. No,
we used to call them cootie catchers. I think they're also fortune tellers.
You could have a game that uses that, and you have instructions in the game book for how to build one and like, honestly, put the numbers and everything in it, or have the thing that you cut out and turn it into that.
I would play that. That's
my goal on this podcast, is to make sure Jess and I have talked about this before too, is like by the time we get to the end of the show, somebody needs to say, I want to play that game. I want you to design that game. So yeah, like you can try really bizarre stuff. What was it? Oh, geez. I've heard of people using bingo cards, using dominoes, both in as randomizers and as building domino chains and having that mean something, the different ways you build domino chains. Mm-hmm. Playing cards. I'm a big proponent of playing cards. Playing cards can be used all sorts of ways. They have so much information in them. Mm-hmm. You can use them in so many different ways. Tarot cards mm-hmm. are great for that. There's ton of information in every tarot card.
My partner has been threatening a game that uses pogs, and I've been scared for a while.
So funny.
It's one of those things that, because even if your mechanics, you don't have a lot, there's not a lot of mechanics. You just need a randomizer, or you just need mm-hmm. a way to kind of pick something off a list. Or you need just a, you know, a yes, no, even if it's just like, you know, you got a branch of yes, no questions or something like that. That's part of the game. Just different ways to generate that. Yeah, you can do some strange stuff. if it becomes a question of like, how weird do you want to get? If it's like, I just listed a whole bunch of things and there's even weirder stuff out there. And Jess piped up with like that right there. I want that. You know, you'll have that. Like if it's an easy game, it's a small game, it's easy to make. You put it together, like you can print out a little booklet or something that's super cheap. And if that's what you're looking to do, sell it or just share it among friends too. I am a firm believer that there is an audience for everything. That you can find somebody who wants to play the thing that you came up with, know how weird it is. The weirdest fun to talk about too. It's fun to pitch.
It is. But I think that like the weird and the fun doesn't necessarily have to be non sequitur, apropos of nothing. Mm-hmm. Like it can be used to drive theme. Like what if the cootie catcher was how you're finding out your yes or no answers or maybe answers for like you're playing a little girl who's like lost in a forest and it's haunted or something. And like the cootie catcher suddenly makes sense because that's her divining tool. Or you were playing like a Mad Max type game and the only thing that you really have on you is like an old rusted coin to make your decisions with. So the weird mechanics can be very thematic and drive home theme and make you feel like this makes sense now. I understand why I'm using this. Is not just hanging off. And of course, any game that involves like ghosts or haunted or weird, the tarot card is like right there. Tarot card is so good. So I love the weird. I especially love the weird as a means of making you feel more like you are the character, because like the little girl lost in the forest probably doesn't have a pocket full of dice that she knows how to read. I don't know how much D&D she's played, but she's probably played like some jump rope. She knows double dutch and she's got a cootie catcher. So
that would be a really fun one. And again, just like perfectly thematic. We've talked about marrying mechanics to the theme in this podcast several times. That's a great example of it. Nevi, what final thoughts do you have for us as we're beginning to wrap up today?
Final thoughts? Gosh, I don't know. We've talked about a lot. Final thoughts on solo games. So, of course, I think solo games are amazing. Everybody should pick some up and play them. If you haven't played solo games yet, if you've been like fence sitting because you don't think it's your style or you think that maybe they're all just journaling games, I really implore you to go out and check out some of these really cool solo games, because they're not. There's a ton of different kinds of solo games. You'll probably find one that you like. I didn't like solo games when we first started playing. I've been playing games since I was like, I don't know, 17, and I'm years old now. So I've been playing a long time and I did not like solo games up until just a couple of years ago. It feels like the whole Panini thing really brought a lot of people stuck at home. They started having more time for hobbies. So there was a huge flood of new games all of a sudden and new ideas for games over the last few years. Like it feels very much like a renaissance. And in that renaissance, there's so many different types of games that you can really find something you like. If you want something that is super prescriptive, where you don't have to be creative, you just can enjoy playing this solo game that has stakes and stuff by yourself, I totally recommend grabbing a game like London Summer. If you want to play something that's more like, I want to have more freedom than a journaling game even, then you should totally pick up something like Ironforged. There's a huge amount of solo games out there. Everybody should try to play a few, because you're actually missing out if you're not already indulging in this kind of side of the hobby.
Well, thank you so much for being on our podcast today.
That was fun. Thanks.
Where can we find you and your stuff?
Okay. So a couple of drakes.com will probably, I'm not great at this whole marketing thing. I think my website should get you everywhere you want to go. I can't guarantee that though, but a couple of drakes.com should get you where you want to go. Where our main storefront is actually still on itch.io. I really honestly love itch.io. It's an indie platform. It has really friendly terms. I've never felt the need to make a standalone store because itch.io is so delightful. So a couple of drakes.itch.io will get you to all of our games, both the big fat published ones and also the little ash cans that I love putting out. We do a lot of community copies. So you can also just grab something to check it out often. And for like the big ones, you can get Court of Blades and Dead Belt on Amazon if you want a printed copy in your hand. And Sean and I are both on Twitter. So I'm at Navi Musing. My partner is at Drake and Dice. We don't really have like a couple of Drake's Twitter. We actually have two individual Twitters. We use it more like to talk about our individual things. So I always make the joke that I'm kind of the chips and beer person. Like I just kind of say nonsense and every once in a while I'll say something profound. And he's over there always like giving like substance, like a steak dinner, like he's breaking everything down. Whereas I'm all like, let's have fun, here's some community copies. I'm very fluffy up until somebody asks me a question, then all of a sudden I put on my professor hat.
I would love to meet you. And did you say your husband, your partner?
Mm-hmm.
Either are okay for you to. I was asking like what title. Yeah, I would love to meet you and your husband, with me and my husband. I feel like we have done a lot of very similar stuff in our game design journey. I think it'd be very fun to meet.
That'd be super fun.
Yeah.
Gen Con.
Yeah, we're actually in Pennsylvania. We live up in, we've recently bought a house up in the mountains. Yeah, so we have PAX Unplugged and we have Gen Con. I made a statement a while ago on Twitter that I refuse to go to PAX Unplugged until they lift their like egregious belly button display being not allowed at PAX.
What?
As one of their, like it's written as one of their hard rules. You're not allowed to... No, aggressive. That was the word. You cannot have aggressive navel display at PAX Unplugged. And I'm like,
what
is non-aggressive navel display?
Very interesting.
The belly button's just kind of hanging out.
Just being groovy. Like, maybe like half showing.
Yeah, they're kind of peeking at you.
Yeah. It's an aggressive belly button display is when you put like those fake vampire teeth in your belly button.
Or angry eyebrows.
Yeah,
belly button.
Angry.
You draw an
Sorry,
angry
I
eye,
got
Brian.
Us off topic. We were wrapping up. So
that's okay. That's okay.
A couple of
I thought it was a strange phrasing as well.
You can find me at Wannabe Games or on Twitter at Joska. And my games are also on Itch and DriveThruRPG.
And you can find my stuff at nerdburgergames.com. That's the website. The games are at DriveThruRPG. There's probably something coming for Hyper Sleep Terminated in the not too distant future, which is a variation on Die Laughing. But this time instead of everybody dying in a horror movie, most of you are dying in a space disaster movie. But you really have to try to make sure one or two people stay alive to get to the win condition and save the day. But a lot of you are going to die. So that's in editing right now.
Thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is Avel by Steph Sachs, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, Steph Sachs, and thanks all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.